number is counting up, it must be working. The recorder. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here. This is the Shuso talk. It's called the Way-Seeking Mind talk. In a sense, it's who am I? Where'd I come from? How'd I get here? And what was the burr under my saddle that made me a Buddhist? So, when I think about how I've come to this place, to Bellingham, to the Red Cedar Zen community and Dharma Hall, to be Shuso, sharing with you the seeming long and winding trail that's apparently led here, words like blessed, lucky, auspicious, charmed, maverick, grateful, generosity, kindness, humble, humbled, and love come to mind. What I'm given to believe and say is my practice doesn't seem to be the result of chronology, a series of causal relationships that describe a straight line leading in a clear direction through space from one point to another point, from no practice to practice. Each point, each moment is a universe entire speaking, opening, yielding, giving each of us. There are no averages. There's only each moment, whether we know we are present or not. We're each this unique snowflake, and we're just as ephemeral. We don't repeat. There are no do-overs. It's not like you have to get it right the first time either, whatever getting it right means. And yet each moment's an opportunity. Sometimes sitting zazen, practicing, it's as though our sense of time is upset. Sometimes it's like one moment, 10,000 years. It could be one moment, 10,000 years of pain, one moment, 10,000 years of joy. Our lives turn on each of these moments. When I look back over my life and I try to give some storyline to it, I find it's much more like the movie or novel genre, magical realism, like bread for chocolate or fried green tomatoes, or, you know. I can't remember the patron saint, the woman in Mexico, the lady who's on all the handbags and t-shirts, Guadalupe, you know. She appears, boom, in the middle of tomatoes. In the middle of preparing lunch, the tenzo. So, in many ways, and in one way, traveling this path is truly a journey without a goal. The path itself is all there is. Most of us spend a long time looking for the path. For me, it seems a long opening to love, heart. And when I say heart, I actually mean my understanding and my experience of this this Chinese and Japanese word shin, which is, I think, been translated heart-mind. So not separating the intellect and the emotions. And not, when I say heart, only meaning emotions. So for me, it seems like a long opening to love, heart, gratitude, and generosity. It's as though this experience has always been here, only that I open to it. When I open, everything and everyone is with me, forever, now, a moment. When I look back from this place and write the past, I'm nothing but a long line of other people, friends, enemies, lovers, family, history, culture, artists, all of whom have given me parts of me. Each has passed to me their light, their hope, their bodhicitta. Each seems forever with me, presences in my being right here. And this includes you. That you are here, I am. I have a birth certificate that says I was born to Maria LaCava Bales and Edgar Hackney Bales at 2:45 in the morning Eastern Standard Time on April 11th, 1952 in Jamaica Hospital, Jamaica, Queens, New York. And that I am John Edgar Bales. Present. Thus it is said. It seems I knew little of what I was stepping into. The meeting of my father's and mother's karma in me and whatever I brought with me to the show. An only child born to a 42-year-old man and a 33-year-old woman, I was loved and wanted and thus lived happily ever after. Well, not exactly. At my home now in Boston, with my wife Jessa, we have a photograph of me as a 1 or a 2-year-old sitting on my butt with my legs extended straight out, torso straight, and this sort of big smile on my face just looking out. And it's done from a couple of different angles. There, it may be one of these photographs like this, yeah, and it has like 4 different little shots and circles. With my legs extended. And the remarkable thing about this, it looks pretty much like I do now. And I don't know if it's remarkable, but of course my beard is not white, and I don't have a beard. And there is actually some hair on top of my head. I think it's toe head. But there's no mistaking this person. It's me. And I was it. The energy, the eyes. It's really sort of remarkable. It's one of those pictures, you know, I had sitting away somewhere in a file someday and your spouse finds it. And they go, wow, we've got to put this up. So my wife looks at the picture and she goes, that's John. And friends look at that picture and they say, the same thing. That's John. And each of us has these photos, and it's not particularly extraordinary. And still, it's amazing. I'm amazed. Where did this guy come from? And how does this guy relate to that guy? How does that guy relate to this guy? What is that? But, you know, I guess I reached about 13, and that's where the next paragraph sort of starts, maybe 14. So much of my life has been about denying or rejecting or not opening to this John that's given, as though I were not it, or more accurately, it was too, my perception of it was too limiting, like a prison of identity to which I would be bound to conform, as though I were a screen onto which people were projecting their image of me, and that the expectations to conform to that image, that role, were my death now. I sensed that very clearly, reasonably early. But, you know, growing up, I grew up on Long Island in New York, about 50 or 60 miles east of New York on what's called the South Shore, on a tidal estuary called the Great South Bay. And growing up here in the 50s and 60s was in many ways wonderful. It hadn't yet been overrun by cars and housing developments, shopping centers, warehouses, and factories. There were a lot of there was a lot of wildlife, a lot of fowl, a lot of a number of farms, and clamming, mussels, crabs. So, you know, there are fish and clams and mussels and tidal estuaries, inlets, barrier beaches, the Atlantic Ocean, tomatoes, squash, autumn, winter. There were creeks and lakes and forts and gunfights and creek mud. Annie Oakley's Bar X Ranch, whoever made that up, if you know. Frankenstein's Shack in the Woods. All sorts of mystery. Playing doctor on Dorothy Corton's porch. Frogs, lizards, fish. One example, I remember this idyllic moment when my father had about a 30-some-odd foot power boat that we would use for fishing and outings in the bay and sometimes out in the ocean and around Long Island. And when after a day out on our boat, my father, mother, and I would be coming in to the marina, and we would be going in a sort of east-northeasterly direction coming across the bay from the inlet. And my father would be at the helm on what's called the port side, left side, looking forward, standing, and my mother would be standing on the starboard side, looking forward. And both of them would be looking forward, and I would be behind them, a little bit, about 5 feet, sitting on the engine box, looking backwards, looking at the stern. As the sun was setting, and my parents are looking forward, and the boat is powering along, just humming, and I'm sitting on the engine box, humming, and the sun's setting. And the sun is setting, and the light from the sun is coming right down to the water, to the stern of the boat, and I'm just totally happy and, like, just calm, and it's as though you could walk from that boat right up to the sun. All was right in the universe. It was one of those moments right out of Carl Jung or something, you know, the archetypes. Soon, though, this secure world was broken. My father was diagnosed with cancer and died within a year, a month before my 11th birthday. Chaos and confusion seemed to come crashing through tossing our life, my mother's and I's, up mine, up into the air and upside down. My father was a pretty active, he ran a small construction company, loved to work outdoors, you know, could weld, take care of things, do his own, do the work he needed to do, and hired people to work, but he was somewhat independent. Loved to garden as well, and I loved to garden with him. I'd become very attached. It was like, even when he'd walk out the front door to say, move the car from the driveway to the garage, I'd say, Daddy, can I come along? Used to irritate him sometimes, but... but he died of a cancer of the thyroid gland in 1963, which is something generally people don't die of today. And it may be that they just caught it too late, but he was also underwent this sort of ridiculous treatment, somewhat more barbaric than even they do with cancer patients now, cobalt. So they burned his tumor in his neck with cobalt, like I guess it's radiation treatment. And my father went from someone who was like a healthy, vigorous man of 6'2", 210 pounds, active and so on, to someone who basically shriveled up to be about 113 pounds. And one of the most poignant experiences in my youth was one day I was mouthing off to my mother when my father was ill. And he turned around and slapped me across the face. And I knew something was up because I didn't feel it. And I remember starting to cry because I didn't feel it more than it hurt. Then one day I was coming home from school, getting off the bus, and I looked up the street and saw our doctor's car backing very fast out of our driveway and then zooming down the street. And as the car went by, I remember looking in the car. This is one of these moments is 10,000 years type things. It's just like, I remember seeing the doctor. He was very upset and he was crying. And I knew, but I didn't articulate. And I went home, and my mother came to the door and sent me next door to be with a neighbor, Mrs. Kramer, who took care of me. It's very, that was a, yeah, definitely a key point in my life. At any rate, my father, one of the great gifts my father gave me, amongst many, before he died, is that he tutored me at home after school in the evenings for 2 years. So sort of like fourth and fifth grade. And he didn't feel that I was learning what I should be learning in the public school. And although he went to private schools, he didn't want me to go to private schools for some reason. So the remarkable thing is, so he started tutoring me, and he taught me math, this is by the time I'm in fifth grade, through algebra, and writing skills, and science, and various things, all from regular books and learn to do math type things. But unwittingly, he set me up for a career of cruising through school. The cruising didn't really strike till about eighth grade, when 4 years later, finally the anger erupted. And I began to realize there seemed to be a disconnect between who my mother, teachers, and coaches, basically adults, thought I was or wanted me to be, and not so much, I say here, who I thought I was, but it wasn't so much who I thought I was. It was more like what I didn't know and what it seemed they didn't know and that nobody ever talked about. Well, we didn't know. Nobody ever, ever, it was always too uneasy. A couple of simple one example would be, you know, I was smart enough to be, I guess, and to be in honor society and a couple of things like that and have some athletic trophies. And I remember one day having an argument with my mother, or just being a jerk, not really having an argument with my mother. And I grabbed this plaque you get from the Honor Society, threw it on the floor, started jumping up and down on it saying, "This is not me." So no one seemed to want to address the missing in my life or our life. So there seemed to be some rupture. And the more I looked at this, the more I found other kids in the same circumstances. Alcohol, drugs, promiscuity were not far away. And with school and athletics on cruise control, I was sort of able to maintain what I experienced as a sort of alter life. I referred to it when I spoke in Vancouver as sort of the local demi-monde. There were just, you know, a whole group of us who were single-parent children or children of parents who were having affairs or alcoholics or whatever, and we would hang together and commiserate, basically, and explore something beyond... I wouldn't say it was explore. It wasn't like we were... It was like we knew we lived in this world that was through the looking glass. It was clear. So it led me in many ways, other than the list of things, you know, alcohol, drugs, and promiscuity type stuff, I also was into reading, and I would read poetry and Allen Ginsberg and Bertrand Russell, Hermann Hesse, and Sartre, and various other people. In some weird way, I understood that the two different worlds couldn't talk to one another. And I also realized that I was pretty lucky because I could get really good grades and I could do well in athletics, and I saw that as my ticket out of my hometown, basically. I didn't have to study very much. And so I had these two worlds going on. One identity was the good student and athlete, again, how that was going to get me out of town. And then the other, had I acted on it too much, would probably condemn me to some life in proximity to my hometown, which is not where I wanted to be. You know, I did have some friends who ended up in a second floor walk-up over a retail store on Main Street and Bayshore. Without too many prospects. So, where do we go from there? The remarkable thing is that I actually survived. And excuse me. Yeah, maybe that's it. Okay, good. Two. Is that three? Blah, 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 blah. Got there. Yeah, okay. And one of the best things that actually happened to me is I got out of town and went to a good college that I was accepted into. And I was finally at a point that I was far enough that I could make a choice, far away from home, far enough away from home in the old sort of John to make a choice. And I chose not to continue with sports, and I chose to explore philosophy and poetry and so on. And I had some very good luck. I somehow stumbled into a course on Chinese history and culture, and found myself shortly thereafter reading things like the Diamond Sutra and the Lankavatara Sutra, and studying the poetry of Sutong Po and various people like this of Tang and Song Dynasty China. And I remember reading the Diamond Sutra, and I said, God, these people actually, I mean, they're talking like I think I'm seeing the world. These are the first people I've ever run into who seem to make sense to me. I've got to find out who they are. Then there was one other instance that actually catapulted me out, that allowed me to say, okay, I'm going to go follow this. I have to follow this. I actually have no choice. And that was, I'd gone through this work of putting together an independent concentration because I couldn't fit what I wanted to do in what existed, that included Buddhism and various other elements across a number of concentrations. And where I was, you had to put the whole thing together. You had to get your 3 years of tutors and get your senior tutor lined up for your thesis and then submit this to the board or something or other, and they look at it. And hopefully the senior tutor that you've set things up will speak for you as well, and you know, you go on. So I got that all set up, and it took a while, and then I sort of realized, God, I may have to be an academic. And I wasn't sure that I could commit to that, and I wasn't particularly impressed with the academics as far as what I perceived as the quality of their lives and their relationship with the world. Then I was visiting a friend in Vermont, and I was driving home, and I totaled a car. It was quite a remarkable experience. I was driving home from Middlebury, Vermont, heading for Long Island, and I was crossing the Hudson River on this small bridge, and I was driving a little MG. It was early in the morning, and I came around a curve, and there was a lip right at the edge of the bridge, and it was a metal grate bridge, and it bumped up the back end of the car as I hit the bridge, and the tires came down, and it was an old bridge, and the grates were wide enough to actually catch the wheels, the tires of this car. So then I remember sitting in this car doing 360s, careening from one side to the other side as I was going, the sky, the river, you know, different things. And then I look up, and this person is entering this bridge from the other side in the car. And luckily, the passenger side of my car went slamming into his front end. And I remember jumping out of my car and running over to see that this person was okay. Remarkably enough, I didn't even have a bruise on me. But I also, being a kid of those days, I had no identification on me. And that time I worked for a state park, so I had we had these sort of skivvies, I don't know what you'd call them, some type of uniform, but not quite a uniform. It more looked like a prison outfit. It's sort of gray, dingy cotton thing, and I was heading to work directly, so I figured I'll put it on and get there. And at any rate, this is 400 miles from home, and I was compass mentis long enough. A state trooper arrived. I was able to tell him who I was and what my phone number was, and then I passed out. And I woke up in a hospital a couple of days later. After having this very serene sort of experience, I actually left my body from the hospital bed and rose above the bed and was sort of in the corner by the ceiling and the wall there. And I was watching the doctors come and go, and you know, the nurses and so on. And then all of a sudden, I woke up and my mother was at the foot of the bed. And this is just what a mother loves to hear, you know. I go, what are you doing here? God. You may get the picture why I don't have children. But So, you know, I had this experience and it was like, God, everything is really okay. Like, it doesn't matter. And that I'd been doing TM prior to that, and I'd been having these experiences in TM where it was like I would become almost, I would feel as though I were, what? Like you could put my hand through me or something. Or if I got up too soon after meditation went out, I'd think I could walk through the door, you know. At any rate, so I had this experience, and I remember driving home, and my mother obviously was upset, and I remember saying to her, don't worry, and then I used this dumb phrase, like, it doesn't matter. Everything is okay, you know. And she didn't particularly buy into that. But something happened, you know. And when I went back to school that next semester, it became very clear to me that I ought to go practice Buddhism. The interesting thing too is I also found out that I stopped doing TM because I had the proclivity to sort of take off and started sitting Zen, where you don't go anywhere. and took a long time then, you know, I trundled out. This is February 1972. The second semester of my sophomore year was starting. I called my mom up and said, I'm taking a leave of absence. It's just what your mom wants to hear. I think, you know, she didn't go to college. She grew up in Brooklyn, the youngest daughter of eight children, an Italian immigrant, brought up mostly by her stepsister, or half-sister. Apparently his father, a number of wives had died. Things like the flu and all that stuff were pretty nasty then. At any rate, she didn't particularly appreciate that, and I couldn't particularly understand it, and I didn't exactly have the emotional space to be able to explain it to her in any way. You know, it's all reaction, at least in the conversation with my mom. So I went out to the Zen Center, hitchhiked out, checked it out, and then I did this thing where I said, yeah, this is where I want to be. Actually, I left thinking I might go to Japan, but then I met these people who sent me here, and I went there, and then I met people at the Zen Center in San Francisco, and yeah, this works, and so on. So then, I went back home, and I told my mom what I was going to do, and then before I left home, we took a trip together around the United States. She'd never been beyond Pennsylvania. So here I am, this 19-year-old guy with actually a beard and long hair, driving around with his mom in a Pontiac Catalina around the country, staying in Holiday Inns and what have you. having a reasonably good time, being not as difficult as I might have been, I think. And then we got to San Francisco, and I showed her the Zen Center, and then we took a trip down to Tassajara, and I showed her Tassajara, because I wanted her to know that I wasn't, you know, going off to Guyana. I didn't know that yet, but go off to Guyana to take Kool-Aid or whatever, you know. And that this was, yeah, this really made sense considering what I was studying, and these people are okay, and the stuff that happens here, you know, isn't so bad. And then we drove home, the northern route, whatever. And then I came back and took up residence at the Zen Center operation. And my first job there, I used to work at Kirby's Ice Cream Parlor, which is at the corner of Laguna between Fell and Oak, I think, where the old expressway used to come down. And that neighborhood is known for its poverty, prostitution, male and female, drugs, so on and so forth, and I would work at this little ice cream joint making banana walnut ice cream or whatever and serving it, and we would close like at midnight. So somewhere after 10 o'clock at night, the heroin addicts and the transvestites, cross-dressers, and prostitutes would show up looking for their sweet fixes with runny noses and so on. And then also across the street, there was this wonderful blues bar that was all frequented by black people in their 1970s, you know, what clothes looked like then from whatever those movies are. And I remember going to that place one night, or two nights actually, with a woman named Peggy Regu, and Peggy was also a young Zen student who left to become a lawyer, went to Berkeley. But, yeah, so there we were. And then slowly I got more entrenched and more involved in the Zen Center. But my aim basically was to go there to study, to find a job that would support and pay my rent so I could work 4 or 5 hours a day and sit Zazen and basically study Buddhism. And I did that. And then, you know, shipped off to Tassajara for 3 years and then came back and was involved at Green Gulch for a little while and was involved and was ordained. And Richard Baker was my teacher. And I had, you know, I had some incredible contact with him. I think Richard was the first person that I really met who I felt I could talk to. And one great thing, I think, and one important thing in Buddhism is being with a teacher you can talk to. Whether what you say means anything, but if you have the experience that you're able to say things that are you expressing yourself, this is good. And the only way that a teacher can help us is for us to speak, to reveal ourselves to them as we reveal ourselves to ourselves. It's easily a two-way street. We have to put that energy forth. And to find someone that you can work with that allows that to occur is really great. I was fortuitous enough that I, in fact, met Richard, and we worked together, and I felt very close with him for many years. And he was able to hook me up with my next mentor, who was a woman on the East Coast by the name of Nancy Wilson Ross. And Nancy is dead now. She died in 1987. She was born in 1904. She comes from more or less this neck of the woods. I think she grew up in somewhere down near Olympia. Her family came, what was her family's name? I may remember it, but they came from New England to the Northwest in the mid-19th century and were involved with lumber or something. She was one of the first, she went to the University of Oregon and graduated from there like in 1920 something or other. Was a bright woman. And she, amongst incredible history, she was involved in Buddhism in New York way back in the 30s with, there's a Zen teacher who was Sokeyan, I think his name was. The first Zen Institute of America grew up from his, and a woman named Mary Farkas established that. And Nancy was deeply involved and central in getting, helping to get Buddhism established in Western, I'll say, rich people's culture, so to speak. I mean, she was on the board of the Japan Society and the Asia Society and wrote a number of books and was incredibly well-connected and helped the Zen world of the 70s actually make connections with people who had money to support it. So the Johnsons of Fidelity World, John Rockefeller and Lawrence Rockefeller and can remember, the Chester Carlson of Xerox. These are all people who gave millions of dollars to establish Buddhism in America in the 70s and 80s, and were very friendly. And they helped the Zen Center, and they helped other Zen Centers. They helped, I guess, Edo Roshi as well. And I was lucky enough to be involved with Nancy. I helped her write her last book, which I think is called Buddhism, A Way of Life and Thought. And as she said, this book, she would say to me and a number of us, this is for your parents, so that they can get some sense of what you're doing and how you're doing it. It wasn't meant to be necessarily a Dharma book, but it was meant to be a book that could familiarize people with the culture from where it came and the things and the stories about how it was organized. When I came back to the Zen Center from Nancy's, I spent pretty much like off and on 3 years there in New York City, sort of Upper East Side type stuff, and the North Shore of Long Island, and met incredible, remarkable people. You know, I remember one day riding in a taxi from some party, and I'm this 25-year-old kid from a place called West Islip that is basically a block of split levels, and I'm in a taxi cab driving north uptown from Greenwich Village with Franz Klein's wife, and you know, just amazing things, getting a private tour from Blanchett Rockefeller of the Museum of Modern Art Cezanne show, you know, it's like magic in some funny way. At any rate, when I came back to the Zen Center, I became Dick's assistant, so I was sort of like 24/7 with him and worked hard and did things. And at a certain point, Dick and I, it was about 1983, it was like, this is another aspect of how you relate with your teacher. It was like I couldn't talk with him anymore. It was like, in fact, almost like my experience was he was blocking me in my practice. That in fact, certain situations were happening where it didn't feel helpful to me. So I'd been at the Zen Center from, you know, 19 to 32 or so, I guess, 32, this 32 year, and I thought I wanted to go off and return to the university, finish up there, and go off, see what the world was about in some way. Dick didn't particularly like that idea, but it wasn't that at all that happened, that really. But so then, of course, the events of 1983-84 unfolded, and at that time I was the Eno at the City Center, and so I decided to stay another year to help, if I could, stabilize things. And I did, and then I felt very strongly that, hey, wow, it's not working with Dick anymore, and the number of people who are just senior to me, who looked like they were going to, at the time, it looked like to me, sort of take control of the Zen Center, if you will, I didn't feel as though I could mature there, and I felt I needed to be someplace else to learn and study. So I left, and I went back to the university, and I got some degrees, and then I went into business to pay off my debts, and then I built a division of a regional financial planning firm from nothing to relatively a good-sized business. And then at a certain point after doing that, I'm very good at sort of zeroing in on something and then focusing on it and getting it done. That's where maverick, the term, comes in. And so I did that, and it was really great, and I was totally engrossed in it and made this thing happen. And then one day I woke up and I said, I'm in management. And I'm really a nice guy. No. But I have a really hard time managing to what I call the status quo. And I'm much better at starting things up and making things go and then getting the next thing going. So my partners agreed. And so I went back more into personal practice and at the same time fell in love with sailing. And then, I'm dangerous. I fall in love with these things. And the next thing I knew, I was applying to be in a sailboat race around the world. And the next thing I knew, I was accepted. And the next thing I know, I was studying weather and navigation. And I was the navigator and tactician on this team race around the world with 12 identical one-design yachts in 2000-2001. And I did that, and I came back, and it was like, God, I can't be in an office. I'd been outside so much, and it was so wondrous, the idea of being in one of those offices, not the experience, my skin crawled. But, God, there's so many stories to tell. I can't tell you what it's like being out in the Southern Ocean, or I can, I'll tell you this little bit. The air temperature is 32 degrees, the water temperature is 32 degrees, the wind's blowing 50 or 60 knots, and the seas are 50 feet high, and it's pitch black, and you're wet, and we only have two people on deck, one person manning the main sheet on the big main sail to let it go in case big winds hit, and one person helming, and I was one of the helming people. The main sheet person could only stay on deck for 15-minute stints, and the helms person could only helm for 30 minutes at a time, and then we'd switch. But from here to where Karen is would be the main sheet person, and I'd be on the helm, and I could shout at the top of my lungs, and she wouldn't hear me. However, you're dead dog tired, and you're going to get awful wet, and despite all this high-tech clothing we had, and you don't necessarily want to go out there. A little bit like Zazen sometimes. but you do, and then what happens is the southern lights appear. And the sky starts filling in with this great beige and amber light that's crawling up sort of the sides of the horizon and wiggling. And then it sort of forms this dome over you, and there's green and blue and red in it, and it's going shh. You feel like you're in this incredible cathedral. Like you forget you're freezing to death and soaking wet and the seas, you can't see anything, and there are icebergs out there, and then there are these things called Magellanic clouds, which are like they, for all intents and purposes, they appear in the sky in the dark of the night like a white cumulus cloud, and what they are is this cloud of negatively charged ions that are just swelling and going. It's amazing. So anyway, I got back from this trip, and I became a professional sailboat captain, and would train people to sail boats in the ocean, and sail boats from New England to the Caribbean, Caribbean to New England, across the ocean and back. And despite all this wonderful stuff, one day, a friend of mine, whom I was ordained with in 1977, and David is a teacher in the Shambhala lineage now. 2003, I think it was, David called me up in November and said, John, I'm going to be in town for 5 days. Can I stay with you? And David and I had been remained friends since we were kids. We both arrived at the Zen Center when we were 19. We both were out there at Green Gulch breaking clods of clay with rakes and so on as volunteer labor. And then he came and he visited, and we had a good time and great conversations. And then I took him up to Karma Choling in northern Vermont, where he had a big meeting and met some wonderful people. And then I came back home, and he had his meeting, and then he went back to Germany, and then about 3 weeks later, he called me up, and he said, John, I'm leading a program called Sutrayana Seminary at Dechen Choling in France. It's a 30-day program. Do you want to come? I said, sure. Just not even thinking, and or thinking, but not hesitating. And I went, and I had this incredible experience. The Sutrayana Seminary is about studying the what we're reading, the one book we're reading, the Bhikkhu Bodhi stuff, what's called the Hinayana from the Mahayana view, and also the Mahayana through what's called Madhyamaka, Nagarjuna, Vimalakirti, so on, and the foundations for what's considered the Vajrayana path. And while I was sitting there doing this practice with these people, it was like I had never left. It was in me. Sitting, talking, walking, listening to the practice, reading. And I had understood incredible amounts of things that I didn't particularly understand, not that I didn't understand before, I don't understand exactly how to say it, but like, they made sense in a way that it wasn't like these big things going off, it was just, oh, this is the way things are. It's not even like you have to do something, but you have to do something to share it. So I said, yeah, I have to do something to share it. So I got home and I called Norman, and he said, yeah, well, I'm going to be in Massachusetts on such and such a, and I said, well, okay, let's get together, and we got together, and the next thing you know, we're almost over, or at least we're almost up to now. So, the next thing you know, I'm at a sesshin at Loon Lake, and it's raining and cold and much like, well, even not as much light as there is now, and I enjoyed it and have a great time and love the people there, and the next thing I know, I'm at Samish Island, or actually I'm with Norman in Mexico somewhere, and then I'm in Samish Island, and then someplace along the line we agree that I ought to be Shuso, and that my practice, as I seem to recognize in 2003, was not about me, but about being with other people, and that we ought to recognize that together somehow. And so Norman and I hooked up, so to speak, and I'm Shuso, and participating in transmission process and learning how to become a Buddhist teacher, for which I'm very grateful to all of you for having me, and to Norman for making it possible, and to all these people in my past for making it possible. So let's end with thank you. Great. Thank you.